All right, you're live on the Arms with Glenn
and John.
Woo! It's another glorious week in the AR500 Armor Studio.
Woo!
We're excited to talk about all the good stuff we have to talk about today. Got a lot of shit, a lot of good stuff.
Yeah.
To talk about today, I'm excited. Thank you to all of our patrons for being a part of the show. Remember to check out all the extra stuff. We got extra shows. We've got the blogs. We've got the show reviews. All the stuff you guys get access to on Patreon. And if you guys start participating in some of those things more, we'll bring the giveaways back, which we were doing monthly.
Yeah.
But then we didn't really have a lot of participation. So for those who were participating, they were freaking cashing in for sure. We might start those back up around January, February. People, you know, start.
That'd be cool.
Engaging a little bit more. We'll see. We'll see what happens. You know, whatever.
You never can tell.
We never can tell. All right. All right. So, first of all, we got to get the sad news out of the way. Minnesota National Guard bird went down. Did you read about that?
No, I heard about that.
Stateside. Yeah, stateside. A Black Hawk with the Minnesota National Guard crashed and killed three aboard.
Oh. Minnesota.
Yeah, I'm trying that to get the details here real quick. Sergeant Plantenberg, warrant officers James Rogers and Charles Nord. They were with the 2211th General Support Aviation Battalion. The three took off in a helicopter in what they described as a routine maintenance flight. Shortly after takeoff, they sent out a mayday signal before they lost contact, crashed into an open field southwest of St. Cloud, Minnesota, and they got there, and all of them were dead.
Oh,
so,
that sucks.
I mean, you know, a lot of people survive a lot of shit in the military and die in helicopter accidents and climbing accidents.
They die in dumpster
crashes.
Car crashes.
Motorcycle accidents when they get back from deployment.
So, I mean, stupid keep training, in mind, you know.
Stupid training accidents.
It does happen. It's like any other job, man. It has there's job-related accidents.
Yep. There's inherent risk in everything that is done.
But it's always sad, you know. Here's the tough thing. Is it more sad if they die overseas, or is it more sad if they die at home?
I think it's sad in different aspects of being shitty, you know what I mean? In one sense, you got a senseless death that you died at home after surviving a bunch of war. And on the other hand, you got a bunch of war that killed you. So, I mean, either way, it just sucks, but...
I think it's perception.
Yeah, it's got to be perception.
I would rather die having spent, like, the previous night with my family than die after not seeing my family for, you know, 8 to 12 months or something.
Yeah, that's also true. But it's all about how people perceive it. You know, people perceive people dying overseas as more onerous.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, they were deployed and they died doing this as opposed to, well, they died in a training accident.
Right.
So it's all about the perception of it. The simple fact of the matter is service members die. Stateside, deployment, doing training, doing normal life stuff, it happens. It's sad when family members die, regardless. So, but I think it's a perception issue.
I think it's a perception, too. And that's part of course, what we always, you know, kind of rant about with the whole even, like, service thing is just because you died overseas doesn't mean you died a hero.
It's true.
Most people who die overseas just die.
So, story.
You know what I mean?
I wasn't there.
The job related death.
Guy.
I'm not shitting on anyone. I'm just saying that.
So imagine this.
It's a tough
job. You're taking a shower.
Yeah.
And a 107 rocket lands in your shower.
Yeah.
That fucking sucks.
Is that a heroic death? Or
no.
Job related death?
It's neither.
Job related, man.
Not really.
Your job is in a place where mortars fall out of the sky.
All right. Rockets, but
whatever. Rockets fall out of the sky.
Yeah, you're right.
Are launched haphazardly toward you.
Yes.
With literally no direction.
Tomato.
Yeah, tomato, tomato.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's, you know, sucks.
It all sucks. I remember my father saying something like, during the time of the Vietnam War, I don't remember, I'm going to butcher this, but it was something like, you know, we lost almost 60,000 men in the Vietnam War.
Yes.
And, or service members, I should say. During that time, if you would have had those same people here at home, they also would have been killed in, like, other ways. It was something like that. Yeah. I remember my dad was telling me about this research study he did that kind of helped him get over some shit, you know?
Yeah.
And part of that was kind of like, oh, that I guess that's true. I never really thought about that.
Yeah, there's a couple of thousand people a year service-wide die in training accidents.
Yeah. You know what I didn't do? Get a fucking painting for Instagram Live. I was actually even in, I was in the freaking shed this morning and I did not get, I have all kinds of cool shit in the shed. I'm sorry, guys. I just looked over Instagram Live and I'm like, oh, damn it. Well, whatever. Well, we may or may not get you a painting by next week. All right. A member of the Saudi Air Force, armed with a handgun, fatally shot three people and injured eight others on Friday morning during a bloody rampage in a classroom building at the prestigious Naval Air Station.
It was Jacksonville, right?
A United States military official identified the suspect, who was killed by a sheriff's deputy during the attack, as Second Lieutenant Bob Jones. Just like last week.
No, you're wrong.
Oh, it wasn't Bob Jones?
No.
Oh, shit. Mohammed Zahid Al-Sharami. Oh.
I don't think there's anybody that's ever been a Saudi native named
Bob. Again, I messed up last time, too, with the stabbing.
You gotta get it together, Glenn.
Bob Jones, man. Yeah, it turns out it's Mohammed Zahid Al-Sharami.
And he's a Christian,
because
right?
Some dude made fun of his mustache.
He was one of hundreds of military trainees at the base, which is considered the home of Navy aviation. Six other Saudi nationals were detained for questioning near the scene of the shooting, including three who were seen filming the entire incident.
Weird.
A group monitors online jihadist activity said that shortly before the shooting, a Twitter account with a name matching the gunman's posted a will calling the United States a nation of evil and criticizing its support for Israel. The gunman used a locally purchased handgun, had extra mags, blah, blah, blah. Just another reason, I don't know, maybe we should arm our service members on bases. I mean, I'm just putting it out there.
I mean, you trained them. You might as well let them carry.
Nah, you only want them shooting at the enemy, though. You know what I mean? You don't want them actually, you know, saving and protecting their lives.
Well, yeah. So
you only want them protecting national interests, James, not themselves.
Let's take a small step backwards and think about this. There's actually a group of soldiers that's specifically their job.
Oh, please you don't say MPs.
That's MPs? Exactly what I'm going to say. Like, that's
Jason, get in here.
That's actually their job.
Of course that's their job. But here's the problem. They're at the gates, man.
And no, they're patrolling. Substation.
Yeah, but
they're
not
doing the
but
same.
They're not like a cop, right? Like a cop in the city. So hold on, John.
But
am I supposed to rely on my local law enforcement?
No. Totally different situation.
Is it?
It is. It's a totally different situation.
How is that a different
it's
situation?
It's not a closed, controlled environment. Your house is not a closed...
A military base is not a closed, controlled environment. When a Saudi national can bring a personally owned hand... Don't even try to tell me you don't know dudes who go on a base with freaking personally owned weapons. I know guys on base all the time with freaking personally owned weapons.
Every day.
That's not a closed, secured environment. A closed, secured environment means they control everything that comes in and everything that goes out. The end. That is not a military base. They do not control everything that comes in and everything that goes out. You can drive.
Right.
Dude, how many times you driven through a gate and the guard who knows you, right, the MP dude who knows you or whatever, just kind of like barely glances at you because he doesn't want to disrupt him from telling his cool LARPing story to his freaking bro, right? And the dude's driving by and he just kind of waves you through. And who God only knows what you have in your vehicle.
It happens.
And I'm not advocating that they search service members' vehicles, but I am advocating that all service members to be armed to protect and defend themselves. That I am advocating.
You're not wrong.
That's what I'm saying. It's not a secured facility.
Didn't the Navy, after that recruiter's office got shot up, didn't the Navy allow, like, recruiters to carry or something?
There was something that was, like, some recruiters, I think, started carrying. I don't think they allowed them to carry.
I think that would...
No, they armed.
Did they actually arm them? But again, it was, like, a short, limited period of time. They're like, for 45 days or whatever, right? That's typical shit. We'll let you be armed.
I'd ask for forgiveness, not permission. That's
100%, man.
Yeah, fuck that.
Yeah.
So guardsmen.
I know I'm not the only one in this room who brought personally owned weapons on base. Okay.
So guardsmen in the state of Arizona are allowed to carry in uniform.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, because you're a guardsman for the state of Arizona, right? You're allowed to carry concealed.
Yes.
You have to carry concealed in uniform.
Yes.
Okay.
But there's certain things that you have to do to be able to do that.
Okay.
By the letter of the tag's guidance.
How many people, without outing your bros, how many people do you think actually do that?
A fair majority of the guys I know and work with.
Really?
Yeah. Fuck yeah.
Okay.
Now, as for other places and people, I have no idea.
Who knows?
Okay. So. All
right. Well, off to the next topic, I suppose. All right. Yeah. I can't. For some reason, won't let me access comments.
What?
Dude, Facebook Live is such a fucking piece of garbage.
Duh.
Well, sorry, guys. If you're leaving comments, cannot...
We'll get to them later.
For some reason, cannot fucking access them.
It's perfect.
We're going to watch our own video. That's what we're going to do now. To see the comments, I literally have to watch our own live feed. All right, that's fucking ridiculous.
That's going to get weird.
Whatever. Okay. What else we got here? December 15th. December 15th. I expect both of you guys.
It's a Sunday night.
Settle down. All right. I expect both of you guys, all right, and anyone else in the area who wants to have a little bit of fun, come and join us with McKellar Running Club Phoenix, MRC Phoenix, for the annual Christmas Beer Mile. Now, let me explain how this works. First of all, it's a mile, so settle down. All right. It's not a long distance. Second of all, it's only technically a quarter mile at a time, which is even better. Because what you're going to do is you're going to drink a beer and then run a quarter mile. And you're going to do that four times, all right, to make the Christmas Beer Mile.
Do I get to pick the kind of beer I drink?
To an extent, yes. Has to be at least 5%. We're doing it at Fate Brewing in Scottsdale, the one on Shea. It's $25 to participate. That includes all your beer. And then what else? There's a lot of cool people there. Show up. Enjoy the event. Yeah, they'll have a couple different types of beer. They'll have a light beer for you sissy girls, and they'll have big, stout, heavy drinking, no shit, meal beers for guys like myself.
And they have a dope peanut butter and jelly sandwich there.
Yeah, Fate. So Fate Brewing on Shea, December 15th, 5:30 p.m. All right? It's early enough that you could go there. You're going to be done by 6:30. If you just want to go and have some fun and meet the people and participate and then leave, 6:30, you're done.
I got to check with my boss and see if he'll let me come in late on Monday.
You'll be out of there by like 6:30, dude.
I just want to get drunk.
Well, that's fine. $25 include your beer and the event. Tons of fun. Do it.
Fate Brewery, North Scottsdale. Shane Scottsdale Road?
Yep, Shane Scottsdale Road. Yep. I trained a student yesterday I wanted to talk a little bit about. So I had a student yesterday who did a private med class with us, and he is from Africa. So he's from Zimbabwe. He's been in the States for quite a long time. He's a veterinarian. But where he got his start as a veterinarian was in Africa, like darting wild game. So he had these crazy stories about like darting elephants and what it takes to like dart an elephant. Like he takes an elephant, as an example, like something like 5 to 8 minutes to pass out from the dose of a dart that you give him. And so you have to now, you shoot the elephant, it runs, you have to chase it. Because as it goes down, you have to control its fall so it like doesn't fall and hurt itself or land on its trunk and suffocate itself or damage its ears or do any of that kind of stuff. And then when it's down, you have to manage its body core temp and do all this kind of stuff while they're like checking it and things like that. So it's all a very controlled process. But he's telling me about this whole thing. It's very interesting. And then he's telling me about being in America and some of the things about the contrast about being here and being, you know, growing up, being born in and really living in Zimbabwe. And one of the things he was talking about was he was like telling me the story about driving over black mambas and how aggressive they are. Like if they're laying in the road, they typically hear the vibrations of the car coming, so they'll move. But then as they move, they'll strike the window of the car, you know, and crazy stuff. He was talking about how crazy those critters are. But he was talking about driving without a driver's license initially because it's too expensive to afford. And he's like, it wasn't until I became a veterinarian that I made enough money to like afford a driver's license that I could like drive around legally. And so he was just talking about stuff like that. And then he came to America. And now he's here and he's done some firearms training and medical training. And he's really getting more into kind of the emergency response stuff and shifting away from just increasing his professional capabilities. Because he's like, I'm gonna go pretty well-known veterinarian at this point. I'm pretty, you know, I've expanded my mind a lot and everything there. And he's like, I'm still improving there, but now I want to start doing other stuff. You know, he's going to start becoming a pilot, and he's doing more shooting stuff and more medical outside of veterinarian work and everything, which is pretty interesting shit, right? So the interesting part was how he described why he does so much learning. He was like, in America, you have so many schools here. There's so many training opportunities here. And he's like, I recently just got into firearms. He's like, I've used firearms professionally when he was in Africa. He's like, but I recently just got into firearms. He goes, I don't even keep a firearm like with me or on me for self-protection. But he's like, it's a man's skill to know how to pick up a gun and use it. Maybe I'm picking up someone else's. Maybe I'm picking up my own. He goes, but it doesn't matter whether it's a Glock or a Smith & Wesson or whatever. I should be able to pick it up and use it. Same with a rifle. You know, and I'm like, wow, like that's a really great experience. That's a really great attitude. And he was just kind of gave me really his input on why he thinks so many Americans are kind of failing in their self-enrichment and their self-education because of all these opportunities we have. And he was like, dude, he was like, in Africa, you don't have these opportunities. You don't have all this schooling. You can't do all these things. We can't just shoot. We can't just carry guns. We can't do any of that stuff. It's just another good reminder of not to take advantage of what we have, you know? I mean, this guy's just soaking it up and doing everything he can the whole time he's lived here.
Don't take for granted what we have.
What did I say?
Don't take advantage.
Don't take for granted. Thank you. Thank you for the check.
For sure, take advantage.
Take advantage of it.
Of the opportunity.
Take advantage of it. Don't take for granted. Thank you for the correction. Don't take for granted what we have because, like, dude, that's pretty cool perspective.
Yeah, I've been convinced by a couple of friends of mine that I'm stupid for not going to school and using some of the benefits that are afforded to me because of my unique situation in life. So I will be
not the worst thing you could do, man. Yeah, definitely not the worst thing you could do. I'm still trying to read these freaking comments. Freaking Facebook is still
stupid,
killing me.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know.
So sorry, guys, you're leaving your comments. I'll have to answer your comments or questions after the show. I apologize for that. Whatever. You can get on the Instagram Live if you want and ask them there. We can see those still.
Yeah.
I had another student ask me a question that I wanted to bring up. This student messaged me earlier and said, why do you think some of these organizations, especially in our industry, like donate to anti-gun stuff? And why do some of these big corporations are like manufacturing firearms and literally making money off the Second Amendment, why do they also back up anti-gun rhetoric? And I think some of it is political, where they're trying to kind of secure their position, so to speak. That way they can play both sides. I think some of it is educational. They just don't know what they're doing. They know what they're doing, but they don't know the effect it's having. And then the rest of it's just ignorance. Part of that is this. And when I first got involved in the industry, I was amazed at how few people who were involved in big companies actually were involved also in the shooting sports.
That's because the majority of those people are business.
They're business folks. So you have CEOs, CFOs, COOs, management, all that are not part of our world.
No.
They're not part of our world.
No.
And so because they're not part of our world, they don't think like we do when it comes to defending the Second Amendment or defending constitutional rights.
Mm-hmm.
It's not their thing.
But why donate to anti-Second Amendment?
Because that's their actual beliefs.
Yeah.
Because today they might be the CEO for Springfield.
Tomorrow they're working at Google.
But tomorrow they're the CEO somewhere else. 10 years down the road, 5 years down the road. Look at these companies, man. A lot of the companies have big time turnover within their management and their operational structure, and they're being bought by this company, and then that company's acquiring five companies, and then that's now part of this conglomerate company, and then the owner of that conglomerate company is like this other person. I mean, most of these companies, they're putting out these cool pro-gun ads, are doing it because that's what they're doing to get you to buy their shit. So it's like really important that you pay attention to the companies that you're doing business with. What are their actual beliefs? Who are you actually giving your money to? Like, one thing I always tell people is go to a shooting competition. Just go to one. Yeah, don't participate if you don't want to, but you should be there participating. But if you're not participating, fine. Look at the banners of all the companies. Write down their names. All the banners of all the companies that donated to the event. Now go to another shooting competition. Try to pick something different. Like if you went to a handgun comp, maybe go to a rifle comp, go to a shotgun comp. Write down all the companies that are there. You're going to notice a trend. You're going to see a lot of the same companies, and you'll notice a lot of local names there, of course. But from a big perspective and a local perspective, you'll start to notice a lot of the same companies. Mm-hmm. You might want to pay attention to that because these are the people that are putting forth support, true support for the industry and for the shooting sports. And that makes a big difference to me because that's my whole reason for being here. Is I want this whole way of life to continue, and it can't continue without the support of some of these big companies. And we're not getting it because they're not part of who we are, right? They're not champions of the Second Amendment. They're not red-blooded patriots. They were just hired into this position to do their job, and they just as happily go do it for Chevrolet as they would for freaking Springfield. They don't give a shit.
Yeah.
So it's something that, you know, you definitely want to think about. Now, I'm not saying that for all of them, of course.
No.
But there's a number of them, yes, that are donating to anti-gun and, you know, liberal agendas. And you should probably pay attention to that because that is pretty important information. I wanted to see if I could find this little piece of information. NRA Chief Wayne LaPierre received a 57% pay raise in 2018. His overall compensation from NRA now. Are you guys fucking ready for this shit?
No.
The NRA is now paying Wayne LaPierre, as of last year, $2.15 million.
To do what?
Receives a base salary of $1.3 million, a bonus of $455,000, and other reportable compensation of more than $427,000. Also received an additional $73,000 in retirement and other deferred compensation. Dude, it's like the NRA just can't stop being a fucking piece of shit.
Yeah.
I just can't understand it, dude. You're telling me a nonprofit needs to pay this dude $2.15 million? And I'll tell you something. I sat next to Wayne and his wife at an event several years ago and had a chance to talk with them. And I felt like, you know, they're kind of genuine. Like, I kind of like what they were talking about just in basic conversation with the table. Then they got up and gave their little speeches, which were pre-canned, pre-recorded, basically, freaking speeches. And I'm like,
bro,
you lost me almost immediately. The next year, at almost the same event, he was not there, but she was, and gave almost the exact same fucking speech.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so pre-canned, I'm like, I was like, I'm reading one of your mailings right now. Stop trying to scare me into giving you money and tell me what you're actually going to do to secure my rights and the rights of my children and their children.
Nothing.
Stop trying to scare me into giving you money. I'm not scared into giving you money. But that seems to be like their primary tactic, which is freaking bullshit.
Well, what do you think of GOA?
So GOA and FPC are good to go. Right, yeah. Farms Policy Coalition might be the best one.
Really?
GOA, Gun Owners of America, phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. Locally, Arizona Citizens Defense League, of course, you should absolutely be a member of them. These are organizations that are legitimately grassroots organizations that are doing good things locally and nationally. You know, guys like the FPC and the GOA are now gaining momentum, enough momentum where they can have effect on policy. It used to be the NRA was kind of the big player, man. It was really all we had.
It was NRA or nothing.
And now we find out they're not.
Yeah.
Now it's GOA, FPC. NRA is just continually sliding farther and farther and farther down the freaking scale.
Good, get rid of them.
Again, they're doing what? They're doing what I just talked about.
Nothing.
They're not doing anything. And it's like you.
They're sending you a free duffel bag.
I want to be like, Wayne, what are you carrying right now? We're all sitting around a table at a gun conference for gun instructors, right?
What are you carrying right now?
Yeah, he's not even carrying a gun. It's like CCW instructors who don't CCW. You know what I mean? It's like that kind of shit. Like, dude, yeah. you don't even, I can't even like fathom that level. Where are you at with this? Over $2 million? Really? That's what you need to make a year? I understand proper compensation. I'm not saying the guy should only make $100,000 or some bullshit like that. He should be properly compensated for being the head of a large organization, but it's a nonprofit organization. And I'm sorry, when we're right now battling uphill for gun rights and you're going to give an increase in pay, I'm not interested. Not interested. It's like Wounded Warrior Foundation.
See, and I'm a huge believer on that is you get what you pay for. And like Wounded Warrior Foundation, yeah, it's a nonprofit, but you want a guy who knows how to run a company to run your company, even if it's a nonprofit. You want him to be successful at it. So that's another, you get what you pay for. Now, does it suck that the guy makes $1.5 million a year at Wounded Warrior? Yeah, but I mean, the guy's taking it places that, you know, they couldn't have gone in recent years without him. So that's, I think, a sensitive subject and a catch-22 right there. You know what I mean? It all goes back to you get what you pay for.
It does get to a point, though, where you're like, this is over the top. You know what I mean? Like, this is too much. You don't need to make this much, you know?
Yeah.
So, all right. Red Wire Gear moment. Go.
Practical gear selection and setup. Buy stuff that's practical to your life that fits your lifestyle, and then set it up to where it suits your lifestyle and suits your needs. Just because you saw some Snake Eater, Delta, whatever, using something in a certain way doesn't mean that's what's going to fit your life. So make sure the things that you buy and use actually fit your life, and if they don't, reevaluate it.
All right. Red Wire Gear Moment brought to you by RedWireGear.com. All right, guys. Getting into the topic for the day, which is going to be selecting long-range optics and weaponizing math. This isn't the first time we talked about this topic, but certainly we're going to discuss it again and a little bit different. Did anyone hit the comments on Instagram Live to make sure I'm not missing anything? First thing we're going to do is answer some questions that were sent to us, and then we're going to kind of open it up to you guys, of course, on Instagram Live, and feel free to type in your questions as needed. I wish I could say the same thing about Facebook. NRA stuff. Oh, what was it? Go ahead and
get that. Talking about not just pay raises, NRA members paid for LaPierre's girlfriend's living expenses in 2017.
Oh, yeah. There's been all kinds of bullshit with that. Yeah, 100%. Oh, yeah. Tons of shit. All right. Still can't get the comments on here. So if you guys want to leave us comments, please put them on the Instagram Live, because the Facebook, for whatever reason, is not loading our comments. I don't know why, but that's what it's decided it wants to do. So anyways, we'll start with this. I'll kind of go over basically how we teach some of these optics in our classes. The first thing to understand is there's a difference between long-range shooting and precision shooting, right? Long-range shooting is hitting something at long range. And what long range means to somebody is different based on who you are. So for most like carbine caliber stuff, long range for most of those guys is going to be, you know, rifle range or intermediate range should be to 300 yards. Mm-hmm. Long range is going to be anything out to about 500 or 600 yards, or that's intermediate range, excuse me. And then long range for most carbine shooters is anything past 500 or 600 yards. And that's mostly because they can't see, identify, or even reach out to effectively targets beyond those distances, right? For most big bore caliber shooters, you're looking at, you know, 100 to 500 yards being close range, mm-hmm. 500 to 800 or 900 yards being intermediate range, and then anything past, you know, 800 or 900 yards being quote unquote long range, and then anything past about a mile being extended long range, right? So that's kind of when we're talking about distances and terminology, there you go. Precision, however, applies to all ranges. Mm-hmm. So there is a difference between long range and precision, is that long range, we're typically talking about a distance, and with precision, we're talking about a style or type of shooting. So a precision shooting event means that I am shooting exactly what I want to shoot, exactly where and how I want to shoot it, regardless of the size or distance of the target. Mm-hmm. So I can precision shoot my handgun at 5 or 7 yards, and I can precision shoot my rifle at 1,800. Right? And I can precision shoot my carbine at 300 or 400 or whatever, right? Like, precision is at any distance, right? So when we're talking about precision and long range and optics, the reason that all those things are important is because if I'm just looking to long range shoot, hit stuff far away, The quality of glass I'm going to need is going to be more based on my ability to just see the target. I just need to be able to see the target, right? With precision, I'm going to need to be able to see the target, but more importantly than that, I'm going to need to be able to make good adjustments to the optic and probably have good adjustments within the reticle. So how I select my reticle and how I select my turrets or my optic features are going to be different if I'm looking to just long range shoot versus precision shoot, right? So a couple of those things, a couple of the questions have already come up was pros and cons of mils versus minutes. So I'm going to break this down pretty easily, okay?
I'm going to sit here with a blank stare on my face.
A milliradian and a minute of angle, or a mil and an MOA, or an MRAD, sometimes as a milliradian might be called, are units of measurement based on angles and circles, okay? So a milliradian is 3.6 inches per 100 yards, not meters, per 100 yards, all right? And a minute of angle is 1 inch per 100 yards. Technically, it's 1.047 inches. We don't deal with that. Just deal with 1 inch. That's fine.
Because that doesn't matter until beyond
extended ranges, right?
Yeah.
So, and even then, it's a very minimal difference.
Right.
So, because you're talking about, you know, like 8 minute of angle by the time you get out there dealing with it, it doesn't matter. So, in a mil, my adjustments are typically going to be in tenths, meaning that every 10 clicks of a turret elevation going up and down or windage going left and right is going to equal a mil. In minutes, I'm typically 4 clicks per minute, which means every click is going to be a quarter of a minute, elevation going up and down, windage going left and right. With that being said, check your optic, because we have minute of angle reticles that come through that are only half minute adjustments. We just had one of those in class the other day, and we also have them in 8 minute of angle adjustment, which would be 0.125, right?
Jesus.
Which is closer kind of to a millish, sort of. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, half of what a mil would be. A mil in tenths is 0.36 of an inch. So a minute is a quarter, 0.25. So technically a minute is more accurate, right? More precise, because it's 0.25 of an inch per click, which starts to not really matter pretty quickly, because you're dealing with, that's an exponential issue. So yeah, at 100, you're gonna notice maybe, but at 200, not nearly as much. At 500, not nearly as much. In mils, watch your reticle, watch your optic, I mean, because you can get optics that are 0.2 mil, or even US Optics now has one that's 1/20 mil, all right?
Good God.
And so you have to pay attention to what your optic is going to adjust in. Again, long range versus precision, right? So like my carbine 1-6 Vortex Razor, right? It's in 0.2 MRAD or 0.2 mil. That's fine. For the how I shoot that carbine in competition, 0.2 mil adjustments are perfectly sufficient. That means it's moving me 3/4 inch at 100. So if I'm a quarter of an inch left of the bullseye, let's say at zero at 100, if I move it 1 click to the right, I'm going to be 1/2 inch on the other side.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's more a long range shooting optic than a precision shooting, but I'm also shooting 5.56, and I'm typically shooting, you know, 400-500 yards is going to be the first I'm going to take with that rifle. So there you go. Whereas my long range precision rifle, I want 0.1 mils. I want a true, you know, 10 click MRAD system. 20th, 1/20th, nah, I don't really need that. That's, you're starting to get smaller than the freaking diameter of the bullet at distance. It doesn't matter. So I'm not really too concerned about that. So that's one thing. Which one's better than the other? Minute of angle is better math. It's easier math because it's in inches. So it's like 2 minutes of angle at 200 yards is 4 inches?
Yeah.
I was looking at you for the answer. All right.
Sorry.
2 times 2. All right.
2 times 3 minutes
of angle at 300 yards is 9 inches.
Yeah.
Right. Or if it's 9 inches at 300 yards, it's 3 minutes of angle. Right.
Yeah.
It's really easy because I'm just using the whole numbers, either multiplying by or dividing by. It's pretty simple. Right. Once you get used to the math, it's quick.
Yeah.
Now, mils are a little bit tougher because they're in that tenth system. So now that a mil's 0.36.
Don't look at me for an answer.
All right. Or a tenth of a mil, or a, you know, 0.1 mil is 0.36 of an inch at 100, or excuse me, per 100. Now at 200, it's 0.72.
Yeah.
Right? Or at 300, it's 1.08.
Yeah.
Right? Or 400 is 1.44. Like, and on we go, right? And so we get to the point where it's like, we gotta have a freaking calculator for this shit.
Yeah.
Right? And now a mil at 100 yards is 3.6 inches and 7.2 inches at, you know, 200 yards, and it's 10.8 inches at 300 yards, and on we go. So if you do it enough, you're gonna memorize it, yeah. Right? You're just gonna remember that shit. But obviously, there's more math involved in the mils. What I like about mils, however, is it's a base 10 system. So if I have to go up, let's say, 5.5 mils, that's 55 clicks.
Yeah.
Right? If I have to go up 5.5 minutes, I have to do the math on how many clicks that is if I'm going to be counting clicks instead of looking at my number.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say, honestly, there's an advantage to either one. I have both. I have both mils and minutes. I tend to shift more on mils because that's how I was originally taught. But I'm happy to use either one. I wouldn't say there's a big advantage over one or the other, unless you grew up doing like quarter inch clicks and you're a hunting optic or whatever, yeah. In which case use freaking minutes. For most people who don't have a preference, I recommend, and they like grew up in the hunting world, I recommend they go to minutes.
Yeah.
If they want to go into the competition world, I recommend they go into mils, because that's what most people in the competition world are going to be using. Is going to be mils. If you're just like, nope, I'm not doing that, it's going to be me and my hunting rifle or me and my gun or whatever, go minutes. It's easier math. Call it a day, right? Mm-hmm. Types of reticles. Oh my God.
Jesus.
So many options out there. Here's what I look for in a reticle. If it's going to be a reticle that I'm going to use for this kind of work, whether long range or precision, what I'm looking for is I want a reticle that gives me true measurements, not a bullet drop compensator. I do not like BDC reticles because they have preset those hash marks for a very particular load out of a very particular rifle, etc.
Yeah, you're looking at a bullet weight out of a barrel length.
And in atmospheric conditions, etc. Yeah,
in a very like one set thing.
And now I might be able to, you know, for most reticles nowadays in their manual, I can look up what those actual measurements are. So they may say, well, this BDC represents 2.5 inches per 100 yards or whatever, right?
Yeah.
And that's okay, except now when I actually figure out what that means in my data chart, it's like 264 yards. And I'm like, okay, so this first one's going to be my 264-yard one, but what if I need to hold for 175? So BDCs are more of a long-range shooting reticle than a precision shooting reticle. I don't really like that. I like precision shooting. So I like reticles that have preset determination, right? Like, I want them to be able to measure. Again, whether it's minutes or mils, I don't care, but I want it preset. I like reticles that have at least half of normal measurement. So what that means is if it's a mil reticle, I want it to be at least half 1 mil, 1.5, 2 mils, 2.5, 3 mils, at least that.
Yeah.
I prefer even quarters because it's going to help you to be more precise, and for measuring, it's a little bit easier as well. For minutes, typically full bars are going to be in 2 minutes. So it'll go 2 minutes, 4 minutes, 6 minutes, 8 minutes, etc. So again, a half of that would be at least a one. So 1 minute, 2 minute, 3 minute, 4 minute.
Right.
Preferably, I like a half minute one, half minute two, half minute three, right? I want to be a little more precise. What you typically find in minutes is not needed. Most of the time, not needed. So most of the time, one, two, three, four is enough.
Yeah.
Right? Just because there's a big difference there between a half a mil and a half a minute, you know. A half a mil is over almost 2 inches at 100 yards, right? Whereas a half a minute is a half an inch. So you're talking about a pretty big difference there, right?
Yeah.
It's literally, I don't know, 3.6 times the difference. So
look at you and your math skills.
Math skills. So it's typically not that big of a deal to have that, you know, that half minute, but I definitely want to have that half mil capability and preferably quarter mil capability. So that's something I look for. I also look for preferably an open center box, meaning I don't want the crosshairs to actually connect.
Oh.
I want a box, and that box for a mil is typically going to be a half mil large box,
right?
So half by half, and for a minute, it'll typically be like a 1 minute wide box.
So we actually have a question here.
Fire away.
It says, when is the more complicated trimmer style reticle right for the job?
All right, so I'll get into that in just a second.
Coming soon.
I will get to that. So I like that open box, typically with a target dot in the center. Because now I can have a good field of view around the target, and even with a first focal plane where I may dial up the magnification, it's not going to block out my target by making the crosshair so big that I can't freaking see the center of the target, right? So right. I like that center box. I also like, for certain optics, like on my carbine, I like to have a red dot that'll turn on in the middle so that I can convert this low power variable or very fine, you know, magnified optic to a kind of quick action red dot, so to speak. Right. So that's beneficial. Those are things that I always look for in a reticle. Now, what else do I look for? The question is, when is the complicated tremor reticle, or maybe the Horst grid reticle, or the EBR7 reticle from Vortex, or the what's the one from Primary Arms that everyone loves? The ACSS reticle. Or, you know, when are reticles like that beneficial?
See, that one to me is the least busy. ACCS. Because here, I don't like looking through and seeing a ton. Like, I get why that's all there.
Sure.
But I don't like to, because if I'm trying to shoot something way out there, the rest of that stuff,
it's busy.
It doesn't work for me.
And some people don't like it. It's distracting.
That's exactly what it is. Now, there's some stuff where you'll get like some reticles have the little size reference down in one corner, or you'll get like there'll be a different little piece up in one corner or the other corner. Stuff like that's okay.
Measurement stuff.
Yeah, but if it gets too complicated, I can't. I'm just like, nope. It's just too much for the way my brain and my eyes work together.
And that is a perfect example of how we're selecting reticles. Because if you're not going to use the reticle, I don't, like most things, give a shit who else uses it.
Right.
I don't care if the Navy SEALs use it. I don't care if the top shooter in the country uses it. If you don't use that reticle, don't. Like, I like a Christmas tree style reticle for my holdovers and wind holds.
Yeah.
Because I hold a lot with the type of stuff that I do. But I know a lot of people who don't hold.
They dial
everything. They only dial.
Yeah.
They don't need a reticle with a whole bunch of shit in there that they don't need.
Right.
It's great to have that little L-shaped bracket, you know, size reference chart, or like the torso reference charts, or any of those kinds of things, unless I'm not going to need them.
Right.
Now, where those kind of things sometimes come in great advantage, especially like the Horst grid style or the tremor reticle, is especially if I'm going to be self-correcting,
right,
self-spotting, or spotting for someone else through my rifle scope. So like when we're doing team events, for example, team competition stuff, and I have to spot for Jay, right, and he's shooting away, and I'm spotting through my rifle scope, I need to be able to give him exact adjustments for him to be able to correct for. If I'm like, you're about 4 inches to the right-ish, about 12 inches high-ish, and I'm just guessing based on known objects downrange, that can go really wrong really fast. So if I want to give him a good correction so the next shot is a good hit, then he can press the trigger, I can hold my crosshairs on the target, boom, I look at his impact, he's going to have to track some recoil, so he's trying to self-correct, but in the meantime, I didn't track any recoil, so I'm just sitting right there on the target, and I'm going, oh, dude, you're a mil and a half right and, 0.5 mils high, dude. Come down 0.5, you know, push left 1.5, boom, send that bitch. You know what I mean? And that's good for that kind of correction. Or when I'm competing in rifle shooting, I like to have some reference in my reticle that I can quickly look at and say, where the hell was that dirt impact? Okay, I fired that shot and I missed and I had good dirt splash. How far away was that from the target? Right. I only get one more shot at this. I can't guess. I need to know so I can measure, okay, dude, I was like 0.5 off the side. Oh, I didn't hold enough wind. Boom, let me recorrect. Yeah, wind's still the same. Let me push left another half mil. You know, wham, cool, hit, awesome, because I measured exactly. So that's where busier reticles start to come into play from my perspective and from my experience teaching, is when you're going to be self-correcting, self-spotting, when you're actually going to be using it for holding in the field, which not everybody does, or when I expect to be consistently spotting for somebody else. You know, if we've got time, like if I'm just horsing around on the range, you know, and I'm using like my 1-6 razor reticle, which is just a standard mil reticle, you know, up, down, left, and right kind of thing, and someone fires, I can take a couple extra seconds usually on that to kind of measure and be like, average is zero and we're getting some data. That's no big deal. I can use a basic reticle like that to give them a good measurement. But if we need to be able to do it fast, I want those more complex reticles, as long as your eyeball does not get screwed up by them. Sometimes people get totally screwed by reticles. They can't focus on the finer points. They can't really see what's going on. It's tough. It's definitely tough. So you have to figure out what reticle you like.
Yeah.
There's some reticles I just don't like looking at. I'll pick it up like you. I'll pick it up and go, nope, too busy. I don't like it.
Yeah.
Too much shit going on. You know, be careful about putting too much stuff in there. Now, when I'm using those kinds of reticles, one thing I like is numbers. I like numbers on those hash marks whenever I can get them.
Right.
Because otherwise, you're counting, and then that shit gets lost in your head while you're trying to do it fast, and you're like, oh shit, did I count four, or did I count five?
Oh, crap.
And you're like, I got to go back to the center and start again.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you can throw some number references in there, that's another thing typically that I'm going to look for. Illumination, are you going to use it? I mean, again, that's a... It comes on a lot of optics, neat. In competition, I've used it less than a handful of times.
Yeah, the only time I can ever recall really using it was at primary arms 1-4 that I had. You could illuminate that reticle, like that center horseshoe and the dot, right, which was handy. But beyond that, in any of the long-range or precision shooting I've ever done, I've never really found the need for an illuminated reticle. Now, I haven't done a lot.
In low-light stuff, like, and basically when we use illuminated reticles is when we're shooting in the dark.
Right.
Like, and I've shot some competitions where you're literally shooting at night. You have to shoot at night, so illuminated reticles are pretty much a must.
Yeah.
But if you're not going to be doing that kind of stuff, then, eh. But if you are going
to
be doing that,
but there's still also a limit to that because dark is subjective because if it's too dark, your optic's not going to do you any good anyway.
Yeah.
Unless you have a flashlight that gets you to that distance or you're using other...
And in this case, with most competitions, the target itself is illuminated.
Okay.
And so you have illumination downrange.
Right.
So you can see the target, but now you're trying to figure out where your black reticle is in the darkness.
Right.
So what's nice is... having a little bit of illumination, boom, a lot of times it's a timed event, right? So the light comes on the target, you've got to get on the target, adjust, usually hold, because you don't have time to dial, adjust, engage, and if you're only using your black reticle, it's easy to get lost in a black reticle at night.
Yeah, oh yeah.
So nice to have a little bit of illumination. So again, if you see that as a possible application for yourself, then great, illuminated reticle is your kind of thing. First focal plane versus second focal plane. Second focal plane is really appropriate for people who are going to be continually keeping their shots inside of 300 yards. You know, your typical hunter, their scopes are for second focal plane anyway. You know, your typical range shooter, most of their optics are second focal plane, so that's fine. The downside to second focal plane is that if I want to use the reticle at all, I have to be on that setting of whatever it is. Usually it's the highest power, but not always, and more these days with different optics, I'm finding it used to always be the highest setting when everything was like 10 power, but now we have all these crazy variations. Dude, it's somewhere. And on the magnification dial, it'll be marked with a red number or a white dot or a little hash mark. It's always fucking different. And if you can't figure out what it is and just assume it's the highest power and shoot it, find out. But if I'm not on that power setting, then I can't use the reticle to hold. Now, again, if I don't ever plan to hold, then who freaking cares?
Right.
Right? It doesn't matter. But it does matter if I ever plan to hold because now I either have to have a math scale done for all those other power settings, which is possible, and a lot of guys do, especially like law enforcement snipers using second focal plane scopes. They want to be able to be at the lowest setting potentially without the magnification or without the reticle getting too small, or they want to be able to highest power setting without the magnification reticle getting too big. So, again, if you're working inside that 1-300 yard range, you need to potentially make precision style shots close up, then yeah, second focal plane scope is probably a good choice. Downside with the first focal plane is now it adjusts, the reticle adjusts with the size of the power setting. So if I'm all the way down the lowest setting, that reticle might be really small. Or if I'm all the way in the highest setting, the reticle may be too freaking big.
Yeah.
So, you know, once again, it's very contextual, you know. I would say for most shooters and people who are staying inside of 300 yards, second focal plane, unless you plan to hold a lot, in which case go first. That's worth the extra money. For anyone who plans to go to, you know, to intermediate to long to extended ranges, you got to have a first focal plane scope, man. You need to be on whatever power setting you need to be on. You don't need to be worried about whether or not your measurements inside equal up.
Right.
So, you know, that's how I look at it. I would say most of my stuff is first focal plane, except for like my carbine low power variables. They're all second. I've tried some of the first focal low power variables. Didn't really like them. Trigicon's got a pretty decent one. The Night Force NX8 or whatever it's called is pretty nice. But they have a pretty decent low power first focal plane reticle, but not my thing. Minimum magnification. Minimum magnification, again, kind of depends on what you're doing. If I'm looking at, you know, 300 yards being my max, I want a one power mag, you know, maybe two on the highest. So I'm going to be running a 1-8, 1-6, 2-10, probably not going to go much higher than that. If I'm going to be running out, again, intermediate to extended ranges, most of them are going to be four. And that's fine. You're probably not going to spend a lot of time there. You're going to spend most of your time, you'll find, the more you're behind glass, like between 6 and 12 power. I mean, that's honestly where I spend most of my time. And most of that time is spent around 8 or 10. You know, even when I'm at 800,000 yards, whatever, I'm still spending most of my time on that lower, quote-unquote, setting than the 27 power that's capable of. Because the highest magnification I can go to is going to screw me up. Every little movement I make.
Yeah, everything is going to be magnified when you're looking through that. Like, literally, like when you're breathing, it's going to look like your optic's doing this number as opposed to cranking it down to just enough to be able to clearly see what you need to hit.
And don't forget about field of view.
Yeah.
That's a big mistake a lot of hunters and competitors will make, even operational dudes. They'll crank that shit all the way up so they can really see the target. Now it's being magnified.
Literally see as a paper towel.
Literally see the freaking target. Now I send a shot. Now if it's a hunting situation and I miss and the animal runs away, or I hit the animal and it runs away because not every shot is going to drop it dead, I got to know which way it went. But if I'm so zoomed in, I have no field of view. I have no idea, right? Same thing with competition. If I miss or I'm trying to find the next target, I don't really know where I'm at. So again, most of the time I'm spending my time on lower power settings than higher power settings. So some of my optics, like I want a 50 millimeter objective because I want that low light capability or whatever, but so they're by nature just automatically going to like 27 power or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't really care. I don't spend a lot of time on 27 power. It's there, but again, most of my time is spent relatively low power compared to what the maximum of most of the optics are. To me, like a good all-around rifle is like a 4-16. You know, a 4-16 in mag is that's a good all-around gun for sure. Turrets, I like locking turrets. Not everybody does. I do. I like turrets that lock, so that when it's time for me to make adjustments, I have to unlock them by pulling them up or doing something like that. Mm-hmm. And then when I'm done with them and I just want to move around, I like to lock them. My gear loves to move my shit around. I like locking turrets. It's just my thing. Yeah. Not everybody digs that. I also look for turrets that are easy to slip back to zero, and I do look for something with a zero stop built in. So I want a zero stop so I don't go past the zero on my way back down and forget where my actual zero was. And I also like to have really solid clicks. You know, I want the turret to be not hard to turn, but like positive force needs to be exerted. I don't want this thing to spin like a high school gym locker.
Touching go.
Yeah, and some of them are so freaking lightweight. Now I'll tell you here, I've had two students in the last 2 weeks break cheap scopes on hunting rifles getting ready for hunts. Inexpensive scopes is what I grew up shooting. $100-$150 scopes, man. I grew up killing the majority of animals I ever killed in my whole life have been killed with cheap scopes. All right. I'm not saying cheap scopes are a bad thing. What I am saying is that those scopes, especially nowadays, with the way that the scope technology has gone and the way that optics are being pushed, they suck.
Yeah.
They just fucking suck. I see them break all the time. These little $100, $200 scopes, dude, I'm sure someone's listening right now who's like, but I got one I've had for 26 years. That's probably true. And 26 years ago, it was a badass piece of equipment.
Yep.
And it's probably still well made.
Yep.
And I'm telling you, buying cheap optics right now is, they suck. They just do. I see them break all the time. Yeah. And we have a pretty good sampling of shooters because we see shooters all the time. And they break a lot.
You pay for.
Yeah, again, you know, you get what you pay for. In the world of optics, you're always going to get something more for your money. Now, you might not need that. So some people are like, oh, you know, you got to buy a scope that's got to be over $1,000 or whatever. I don't agree with that either. Mm-hmm. But you do get what you pay for. And the more you buy or the more you pay in optics, you're going to get more features. Whether or not you need those features, that's up to you, right? Other things about turrets, you know, again, I like when they adjust the way they reset to zero specific. I like when they internally reset to zero as opposed to externally reset to zero. Because if it's relying on me to perfectly line up a line with a zero, and I'm off by just a little, then as I turn exponentially, it'll get worse. And now I could be 0.1, 0.2 off and not even technically know that. So I like when I can just dial in inside, like the Vortex Razor, for example, is a good example of that, where everything dials. Excuse me. Everything dials on the inside of the optic instead of the outside of the optic. So I like those turrets. Rings and bases, yes. Better money. Always better money on rings and bases. What's that? What do you got?
What cheap or cheap. Inexpensive optic would you recommend?
I don't know. Give me a price range of cheap, because one man's cheap is another man's expensive. So sometimes I sell that. Sometimes I tell someone what an inexpensive scope is, and they're like, what? And I'm like, okay, well, tell me what you think inexpensive is then.
Yeah.
So if you're looking for – are you looking for long range? 300?
Yeah.
300 yards or $300? $300?
$300?
$300 or 300 yards? We're waiting. We're waiting for the requested information.
For someone starting out. So is that
– dollars. Okay, $300. So the Vortex Razor Gen 1s are now on crazy sale, like Sportsman's, Bass Pro, all that place, because all the Gen 2s are such a big thing that I've seen them on sale, even online, for like $350.
There you go.
So that's a damn good optic.
Yeah.
You know, like I have one of those on one of my hunting rifles. I will keep it on there forever. It's a pretty good optic. You can find them pretty inexpensive. Vortex also has a Diamondback Tactical optic that I want to say is around that same price range. It's really good.
I had one of those.
You did. And then I took it from you.
It was a good optic. It's nice clean glass.
There's Leupold has a really good setting. Man, I don't know their models well enough to know what it is, but they have a really good model in about the $300 or $400 range. I would probably go with the Vortex just because of their warranty, man. I freaking love Vortex's warranty so much. So I would probably go with them just because of their warranty. But yeah, I would look at something like that. But I know Leupold's got a pretty decent like $300-$400 optic as well. I just don't know their models well enough to know exactly. Rings and bases, back to that. Yes, get the best ones that you can. If you plan to shoot past, out to, or beyond, 900 to 1,000 yards, get a 20-minute of angle base and get that thing on your rifle. If you're planning to shoot inside of that, a zero MOA base is plenty. Make sure you mount those bases securely. You don't want the base coming loose, because then you're going to take the whole damn optic off. Ugh. Make sure you mount the base securely. Mount every optic, everything, with an actual torque wrench. Go get the fat wrench from your local gun store. Pay the $30 or whatever it is and mount that thing to factory spec torque. All right? Don't be farmer Titan cranking on shit. You will break shit. You will mess things up. Get a torque wrench. Mount your optic that way. Mount it. You get the little pre-made levels. They're like $10 or something. I can't even tell you how many scopes I fixed in classes over the years. Oh, no, my uncle mounted this for me. The gun store mounted it for me. You get in there and you're like, this thing is fucking crooked. It's not set to your eye relief. The scope mounts aren't tight, or they're over tight or whatever. Like, easy shit to fix. Easy shit to take care of yourself. But those are things I recommend. Brand-wise, there's so many good ones out there. Man, go with the brand that sells your optic is always a good place to start. Warn, Badger Ordnance. My mind just went blank. But there's a freaking bunch of them, right? Night Force, Vortex makes good ones. Leupold makes good mounts. There's so many freaking good mounts out there. that's about all I would say, is make sure you spend really good money. If you have like just enough money to get a good optic or good rings and bases, get good rings and bases, because a good base is forever. Or a mount, and then good rings, you can always put a better scope in it later. Yep. But you don't want to put a good scope in shitty rings or shitty mounts, because you're not going to get potentially the capability that you want. Another question?
Yeah. Would you throw the Strike Eagle 1-8 in the trash, asking for a friend, go-to mount or rings?
I would not throw the 1-8 in the trash, but I would definitely use it on a carbine. Or something that was designed for 300 and in. The problem is the kind of fisheye look you get with it is a little weird. But I would look at that for, like a regular carbine, for like a 2-gun, 3-gun type of thing. That's fine. If you're looking to put something on a 22 or something like that, it's great for that kind of stuff. I don't love it, because I don't love their glass quality in the Strike Eagle series. They definitely have better glass quality. However, it's a really good, affordable optic. Same thing with the – they have a Strike Eagle series of rifle optics. Same thing, like higher magnification. It's good stuff. It would be more appropriate for a rifle's going to be shot closer in just because when you start to get further out, you can't see shit. You know what I mean? It starts to – the way that their optics are in that optic.
It kind of starts the glass, to distort.
It starts to distort, yeah. What was the second part of that question?
Go-to rings or mount.
My go-to is freaking American Defense, man. Yeah. American Defense manufacturing for like everything I can possibly get or for my rifle scopes, Vortex Precision matched rings or their new Pro rings. I use Vortex Precision mount rings on pretty much everything. I just started getting a couple of their Pro rings because they just came out this year. So far, so good. They're lighter weight than the Precision match rings, which is nice. I think we're out of live time.
We're out of
time here. But I really, really like American Defense manufacturing.
I didn't see the countdown on there today.
No, I didn't see it either. Huh. So I think that's about all the time we have. I wish we had more time. Last thing I would say is I like side parallax adjustment on optics. Parallax is an incredibly, incredibly, incredibly important thing to adjust while you're shooting.
Yeah.
Every time you change targets, every time you change positions, every time the atmospheric conditions change, every time I change location, I have to adjust my parallax. Pretty much every shot almost. If I'm going to move or anything's going to change, I need to adjust my parallax. So I do like a side parallax adjustment. Other than that, I think we're kind of out of time, unfortunately. What it is. All right. I wish we had more time, but that's what it is. Where are we at?
I wish.
Oh, right at an hour. We're right at an hour. All right, cool.
I wish you had more time.
All right, guys, remember you can bring us out to train with you. Get our host information, info@trainingaz.com. We're happy to come out and spend time with you. Remember to follow us on Facebook and Instagram as all of our companies, Independence Training, Redwire Gear, and, of course, the Arms Room Show. Remember to check out what AR500 Armor has going on. They got some great sales going on for all the Christmas holiday. We're proud members of the Heroes Media Group. Make sure that you are looking at the other shows that they have available. Lots and lots of good shows. We have some other great shows for us coming up this month. I'm excited about some of the stuff we're going to be doing. But next week's going to be a pre-recorded show. So we'll be coming to you in the present.
From the past. But today we're doing it in the future.
So we'll have to change it when we start recording.
The past and the present of the future.
But we're gonna be doing a pre-recorded show next week. No big deal. We're going to be talking about keeping skills current. All skills. How do we keep skills current? It's always something that people are interested to know and ask us. How do we do things? So we're going to be talking about that. And, yeah. Also, other shows we have this month. So I'm excited. I'm going to talk about them. On the 23rd, we're going to have our buddy Neil in here talking about fighting with the Peshmerga. So that's gonna be a lot of fun, and then I think the last show of the month we're gonna do a rowdy roundtable. Last show of the year, might as well do a rowdy roundtable. Yeah, talking about overall life lessons learned. We're gonna be drinking and having a good time.
Sweet. So
it'll be a good show. Until then, you guys stay aware, stay safe, and train hard. You've been listening to the Arms Room.